Today, we talk about a last chance for Remainers in a critical week for Brexit, and abortion campaigner Denise Phelan on the historic decriminalisation of abortion in Northern Ireland.
Well, I've been thinking this is the week where Remainers need to brace themselves for their hearts to be broken. They have had 3.5 years of thinking there may just somehow be a way out of this. And yet it could be that on, you know, one night this week, or maybe it goes into the next week, there is a vote which says this is the deal and therefore we are leaving. And even though you'd think Remainers will have known that since June the 23rd, 2016, there has been a kind of almost legitimate form of denial which has said that, look, maybe it won't happen. And it will be quite hard because just think a lot of Remainers have surprised themselves over the course of 3.5 years by how strong the attachment they feel to the European ideal really is. It's one of those things where you don't know what you've got till it's gone.
Boris Johnson has secured the support of some critical groups in Parliament for his Brexit deal. The most ardent Conservative Brexiteers, more Liberal Tories who want to avoid no deal, and at least some Labour MPs. As the numbers appear to stack up in his favour, the Remain movement that has grown out of that referendum vote is facing its last possible chance to prevent Britain from leaving the EU. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, how Remain became a political identity. Like many of us, Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland has a very clear memory of the early hours of June the 24th, 2016, as it was becoming clear that Britain had voted to leave the European Union.
I had to cycle from home into the Guardian office in through empty, deserted London streets. It was very dark. And in one ear, I had the news coming through and just felt my heart sinking because something which you knew could happen. So it wasn't like it was a complete surprise analytically, but emotionally, I don't think I or anyone else was really prepared for it being real. And so as I was cycling along and came in to the office in the dead of night, you felt as if something very, very profound had changed and was about to change.
Well, just before 10 o'clock last night when we started this programme, I said that it was a momentous day for Britain because it was no less than defining what kind of country we wanted to live in. And the answer to that question, which is one that's haunted politics for a long time, whether we should be in or out of the EU, has been resoundingly answered. A majority decided they wanted us to leave the EU, what perhaps they didn't expect.
And it was that idea of pulling up the drawbridge and somehow Britain going off alone that felt very strong to me as dawn broke that morning. And then it just got worse and worse, you know, seeing the smirking face of Nigel Farage.
A victory for real people, a victory for ordinary people.
Celebrating, saying it's our Independence Day.
As our Independence Day!
And saying that this had been achieved without a shot being fired. I remember how strange and horrible that felt, given that Joe Cox had been murdered a matter of days earlier. So it just felt as if, and I wrote something on that morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, saying it feels like we've woken up in a different country.
And you talk about this kind of profound sense that you have and what you call the smirking faces of people like Nigel Farage. There was a sense among some leavers that Remainers had had this kind of superiority about them, that they thought themselves more intelligent and had unfairly portrayed the other side as little Englanders.
Yes, I think there was a big gap in that debate which revealed a kind of cultural divide that has actually continued till now. Now, it was a flaw of the Remain campaign that it formulated its arguments aimed at the head. They were cerebral arguments, they were analytical arguments, they were abstract arguments. They often had tons of numbers in them, and they were about the economy and productivity and trade arrangements and logic.
Wages would be lower, prices would be higher, and that means that Britain would be poorer by £4,300 per household.
I think the emotional dimension of the Remainer side has been underplayed. I wasn't distressed as I was cycling through those deserted streets because I thought we were going to take a hit in terms of our, you know, trade balance. It was an emotional thing about feeling part of a project that came out of the Second World War and was a determination by its founders never to fight each other again.
It's worth remembering that at the start, it often felt to even the most passionate Remain voters that the best they could hope for was a soft Brexit.
The discussion you would hear would be, and maybe what will happen now is we'll be in the single market and we'll be in the customs union. We won't formally be members of the European Union, but we'll be sort of members in all but name, and we'll call it associate membership. And so, you know, if you were a psychotherapist, you would say this was the bargaining stage, perhaps more accurate, where people were trying to say, look, okay, it isn't as bad as all that. I'm going to try and bargain with the verdict of the referendum.
But it certainly was the case that it felt as if Brexit was going to happen. An overwhelming majority of MPs voted to trigger Article 50. Theresa May was ahead in the polls. She called an election to cement her vision of a pretty hard break from the EU. When did the fight for Remainers turn into a fight to stop Brexit?
Well, two things happened. Theresa May lost her majority and therefore was no longer able just to steamroller the Brexit of her dreams.
And what we're saying is the Conservatives are the largest party. Note, they don't have an overall majority at this stage.
But it suddenly made people think we now have some leverage. But also, I think importantly, the long process of Theresa May negotiating with Brussels to get a deal exposed how difficult it was to get all those Brexit priorities. Suddenly the language became about unicorns because you couldn't have everything. All of her red lines could not be honoured all at once. Something had to give. And so the process of turning a Brexit myth or dream into boring, mundane reality did expose the contradictions of Brexit.
And a lot of Remainers felt that the referendum had been unfair, whether it was the kind of promise of £350 million for the NHS or serious questions about legality. What was driving them at that point to fight to stop Brexit?
I think the more time went on, the more they thought Brexit is actually an impossible idea. It's full of contradictions. It's impossible to ever implement. I think the fact that Theresa May had sought a mandate for Brexit and her version of Brexit and not got it was very emboldening. That gave it a kind of democratic legitimacy. And I think they, as time went on, the points you referred to just then, I think did solidify, at least in the minds of Remainers, that somehow it had been won on a false prospectus and therefore you weren't bound by it.
So Remainers have been fighting not only in Parliament and in court. We began to get rolling protests. In terms of optics, they often seemed more prevalent in affluent areas. They seemed largely white and overwhelmingly middle class. I mean, they were lampooned by opponents as the kind of Waitrose crowd.
What does your dog think of Brexit?
Oh, he hates it. He preferred to be able to go across the channel whenever he feels like it.
Was that a problem?
Very definitely a problem, because even if it was quite unfair, because you can't get 48% of the population just with people who shop at Waitrose, it played into the populist frame of the Leave side, which was somehow the real people, the authentic people, were for Leave, and somehow it was this metropolitan elite who were for Remain. And that has really saddled the Remain side. As I say, I think it's unfair. It's become part of the sort of cultural baggage of Remain and goes to a problem, which is Remain has not been able to find a single or clear popular face or slogan that would somehow shake off that caricature.
And interestingly, when you talk about that divide with Nigel Farage as the poster boy for the kind of hardest form of Leave, if you like, there is a big gap here in that he managed to set up the Brexit Party. The Remain campaign hasn't been able to set up a political party that has had the same sway.
No, I mean, the jury is slightly out on that only because the vehicle has instead become the Liberal Democrat Party. There was an effort with the, you know, Change UK, the independent group, whatever they called themselves, to be that.
This is no rebel alliance. This is the home of the Remain Alliance.
To be the Remain equivalent of the Brexit Party, Anna Soubry, Chukwuemeka and others, and it unravelled pretty quickly. And I think it unravelled actually because there was already another obvious vehicle in the form of the Liberal Democrats. That was the obvious place for Remainers to go.
Our party has been clear on Brexit from day one. We believe the UK's best future is as members of the European Union. And that's why, as your leader, I will do whatever it takes to stop Brexit.
And so that has become the alternative. But we don't know if that's a real move or not, because it hasn't been tested in a general election.
So the Remainers know what they want, and they've been trying to get it. They have had a number of victories along the way, whether it's victories in court or parliamentary votes. They voted down Theresa May's deal with others three times.
The result of tonight's vote is the greatest defeat for a government since the 1920s in this House. This is a catastrophic defeat for this government.
242. The noes to the left, 391.
The ayes to the right, 286. The noes to the left, 344. So the noes have it. The noes have it. Unlock.
Then they get their kind of worst possible Prime Minister in a way, Boris Johnson.
That Boris Johnson is elected as the leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party.
But there's still a thought that he won't be able to get this through, and he surprises everyone with a deal. You set out at the beginning this idea that Remainers should be bracing themselves potentially for heartbreak. Before we talk about what last-ditch options there may be, have there been mistakes along the way? Should they have taken an election when they could have had one?
I think it was difficult for Remainers to see an election as being the solution because of this quirky problem where the main opposition party isn't clearly opposed to Brexit. So an election doesn't give you the binary choice to settle this question. I mean, the other thing I would just say is on this notion that Remainers succeeded in thwarting Theresa May three times, the only reason that Theresa May was denied Brexit three times was because Brexiters stopped it three times. There weren't enough Remain votes. There weren't enough Dominic Greaves.
Now, throughout this whole unhappy business of Brexit, what I've certainly tried to do is to try to ensure that there is a process which avoids chaos.
In the House of Commons to stop Brexit, were it not for the fact that the hardcore ERG, Jacob Rees-Mogg Spartans kept voting it down. The reason why I've been warning my fellow Remainers to prepare for heartbreak is those Brexiters are now on board, and therefore it is much, much harder for Remainers to hold the line. They might be able to do it for a bit with the DUP having switched sides, and maybe they'll somehow get through this and get a referendum. But I myself am girding myself for this decision, because I just think once the Brexiters are all on side for Brexit, it's very hard to stand in the way.
But you say they may be able to still get a referendum. There's also some talk that they may be able to get a vote in favour of a customs union that would take us back to that softer form of Brexit. How do they do that? What are they thinking this week?
Well, it's all about the numbers this week. And I know that plenty of people have been annoyed that we've been talking more about numbers than in a way the content of the deal. But the numbers are there just. Once you are into the detail of the deal, then the coalition of support for it could fracture apart. And that's how Remainers have an opportunity here, because there is an opening, for example, with the DUP. Now, the DUP have conflicting signals on this, but they are a pro-Brexit party, but they are also, the number one, the party of the union. And a lot of Remainers have been trying to explain for a long time that if the whole of the UK stays in the European Customs Union, then there's no problem with the union, because then you can have that soft or invisible border between Northern Ireland and the Republic, and no need for any distinction between the island of Ireland and Great Britain, because we'd all be in the same customs union.
Okay, so it feels as if things are leaning in Boris Johnson's favour, but there is a chance for disruption. Disruption that could result in an election in which Labour could still offer that referendum, or in which MPs could vote for a referendum. If that happened, if Remainers got their referendum, what if it's Leave?
Great question. And I think then, it must be the case that if it's on something specific, meaning a specific deal, and the specific deal wins a mandate in a referendum, it's over. It has to be over. The only legitimacy, I think, in asking the question again is because it was such an abstract option on the ballot paper before. It was just leave, where there are, we've discovered over 3.5 years, 1,000 different types of leave. And so once it's one type of leave versus remain, and if that one type of leave wins, then that's a democratic mandate and it has to be implemented. If you go to the second one, where it's, do you want this new specific future, and people say yes, then remainers have to accept that.
Although one issue that a lot of people on the leave side have with this is that while second referendum supporters say it's all about more democracy, they're almost always people who want to overturn the original result. If that is what happens, if you had a second referendum and it was a narrow win for Remain, but still almost half the electorate has voted twice for Brexit, that's going to cause some pretty big issues for society to deal with, isn't it?
It is. I've spoken to people about this too on the Remain side and channeled the worry you've just expressed, which is maybe it's time to let this go simply because it's so divisive.
You are going against the will of the people. You are called
me a traitor.
You are a traitor.
Right, a traitor.
She's a traitor. You are a,
and I think what they say is the country is divided anyway. And the country is now polarised by the referendum of 2016. Given that we're all divided anyway, are we better able to cope with that polarisation and division with 7 percentage points more GDP or 7 points less GDP? Unfortunately, the damage has been done. We are polarised anyway. And so you're going to have to almost put that out of your mind while you make this decision, because a referendum either way is not going to make that go away.
If we leave with Boris Johnson's withdrawal agreement and then have an election, Brexit hasn't gone away, has it? The future trade deal, the type of Brexit we end up with, is still up for grabs.
I can imagine a next election which will, on the Remain side, would want to be about Brexit, where the argument is, OK, we've got past the withdrawal agreement, but what about the future relationship? And the other side, the Conservatives saying, get over it, it's done, and the electorate rallying more to the latter message. In other words, the Remain side would be right to say, we need to have an argument about the future relationship and all that. But actually, I think the country, out of sheer weariness, would like being told, it's over, forget about it, talk about other things. There is fatigue. It's been 3.5 years, and there are a lot of people who are partly drawn to the message of Boris Johnson, not because they think he's right on Brexit, but simply because they love the idea of get it done, get it over with.
If Boris Johnson manages to pass his Brexit deal, for which he would need Labour votes, ironically, with a harder Brexit than Theresa May was offering, what then for Remainers?
I think probably the reality is that Europe and Britain's place in it has been an issue in British politics for 25, 30 years, and is always going to be. I think a lot of Remainers might find themselves in the position of thinking, well, we're out now, but Nigel Farage and the UKIP crowd were out in 1975. They didn't give up. They banged this drum, often in obscure corners, in meeting rooms above pubs where only 6 people would gather. But they did it, and they kept that flame alive for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and eventually they won. And maybe Remainers are going to have to repeat that experience and learn that lesson and just keep this flame burning. And I think they might be helped by reality, because Britain will discover that it's quite cold on the outside of this group, and the movement to go back in will start probably the day after the Boris Johnson deal becomes law and we're out.
I don't know whether to be depressed or overjoyed by that. And does this movement hold together beyond Brexit? I mean, you've set out how Brexit shifted the kind of political paradigm, how it turned the axis and brought together a new coalition of people. Are they still united beyond leaving the EU, or do they fragment back to their political parties?
Well, this is a fascinating question, I think, because Remain and Leave has become the key dividing line in our politics. You know, now when I scribble in my notebook RVL, I don't mean right versus left. I mean Remain versus Leave. That is now the key axis. There's been some studies of this. There was one earlier this year for a group called Engage Britain, an academic study out of King's College London, and they discovered that actually the British people are not polarising, that people, voters, are converging into a kind of consensus on various liberal issues about gender equality or same-sex marriage or race, the environment, on health and poverty. There's a lot of agreement on those, but people identify their identification with whether they're a Remainer or a Leaver is hugely strong, much stronger than their affiliation to a particular political party. And here's the alarming bit. Not only do they identify much more as Remain or Leave, but they feel a strong dislike of people in the other tribe. They dislike each other intensely, is what those researchers found. And that is something I'm not sure does go away just by passing a withdrawal agreement or, you know, a new arrangements on a customs union. This has now got under our skin. It is how people see each other. And this, to me, is a sign that British politics has become much more like American politics, where Republican and Democrat doesn't really refer to your view of healthcare policy. It refers to your tribe and where you sit in the country. There becomes a huge gulf between the two. And British politics didn't used to be like that. And I fear it is now. And this is a kind of culture war that may find new issues to attach itself to, even after, you know, nominally, for now, the issue of Europe and the European Union has been settled. I fear this is now the fault line, and it is not about to go away.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read all of Jonathan Friedland's columns at theguardian.com and do follow the rolling coverage of this drama at Westminster. Coming up, abortion and same-sex marriage have finally been decriminalised in Northern Ireland. Now, Westminster MPs have successfully secured legislation to end a ban on abortion and same-sex marriage in Northern Ireland. They were able to do that because the Northern Ireland executive, Stormont, has been collapsed for almost 3 years, following a dispute between Sinn Féin and the Democratic Unionist Party. Yesterday, furious members of the DUP, who opposed the move, returned to the chamber, but it was no more than a symbolic act. Today, that near blanket ban on abortion is no more. For campaigner Denise Phelan, it could not come soon enough.
Can you imagine what it's like to find yourself pregnant with your first child, to have all the scans going very well, and then you get to the 19-week scan and you're told that your child has full Edwards syndrome, which means that she is not going to survive. And then the next impact or the next blow that comes is that you're told that you're not going to be able to do anything about it. In fact, you're going to be forced to carry this dying fetus right through to full term. And then can you imagine what it's like to go through every day, every hour, every minute, knowing that child's going to die, to not be able to sleep at night? And can you imagine then what it's like whenever your child does die in utero and to not be able to give birth to her until 5 days later? And can you imagine then having to bury that child into the earth and walk away? Can you imagine the level of hatred and, you know, oppression that you feel as a human being, realizing that the state that you live in has done this to you? And all for no reason, because while pretending that this is all about saving babies, there is no child to be saved when it comes to fetal abnormality. So then you have to ask yourself, what is it about? And the answer is, it's religiously motivated. This is about misogyny, it's about power, and it's about control by the church and the state. We are really ruled by unelected church leaders who use these politicians, or who allow themselves to be used, as puppets by the church. And what we really need in Northern Ireland is a separation of church and state. And from my own point of view, that's the root cause of a lot of the problems in Northern Ireland. But particularly when it comes to human rights, that's what the issue is. We keep hearing politicians and lawyers who know better telling us that, you know, the reason that things haven't changed here is because of the issue of devolution. But we're very well aware that the Northern Ireland Act and the Good Friday Agreement both provide that human rights is not a devolved issue and never has been. And the reason that Westminster has failed to intervene up until now has been for the sake of political expediency. We've been kicked around like political footballs for far too long, and it's not going to be tolerated any longer. We're very glad that the change to the law has happened and that sections 58 and 59 of the Offences Against the Person Act, dating back from 1861, was finally repealed last night. It's 52 years after the rest of the UK had that legislation for human rights, and it couldn't come soon enough. But I think, although it is a momentous occasion and it's a victory for women's rights, we also have to remember all the people who have suffered the trauma and the devastating impact upon their lives. It should be the start of something. It should be the start of freedom and choice. But I think that the Northern Ireland Assembly cannot be trusted to deliver on human rights. And so we're very glad that Westminster has stepped in. And I think that, again, although it should be the start of something fantastic, and we certainly look forward to future generations of young people coming through who are interested in making this place a much better place to live and who are interested in achieving human rights and equality for everyone, I think that while the old dinosaurs are still there, haunting around the rooms of Stormont, that they will do everything in their power to stand against us.
That was Denise Phelan. My thanks to her and to Jonathan Friedland. This episode was produced by Mithali Rao, Courtney Youssef, Chika Ayres and Rachel Humphreys. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.